What's up, everyone? Thank you so much again for joining us for another edition of The Conversation, because as you know, here at ESPN, we're all about Black history always, and not just celebrating it in February or in October as it is here in the UK. Shaka Hislop is joining me as per usual, one of my partners in crime, and another partner in crime, Joby McEnough, is joining us. Absolute pleasure to have you, Jobes. You're forever my captain for the Reggae Boys, you know that already, and now you are leading in other ways as an interim manager of Leyton Orient FC. We're not fully retiring you off just yet, so I'll say player coach too, and we just really can't wait to hear what that journey's been like for you and how you've been finding it, because we do know the stats and we've seen the stats, especially in the last year, given everything that stemmed from, you know, the killing of George Floyd in the USA, and just everyone has started to realize just how rare it is to have someone that just looks like you in a top position and management position in football. So how have you found it?
Yeah, well, it's been pretty hectic to start with, I must say. Obviously, the decision was made and things happened very, very quickly. So again, it's just been a matter of trying to obviously get a focus in terms of the way I want things done. I suppose that's the biggest change. Instead of worrying about yourself as an individual, you're now in control of, you know, 25 players and every other aspect of the football club. So this week's been good. There's been a little bit of a break. I think the biggest thing for me, I've been overwhelmed with messages of support from the whole football community in general, but particularly, you know, Black coaches, Black players have really reached out and, you know, given me words of encouragement, words of advice, words of support. And again, I think that makes you feel that much more there's an importance to the role, certainly. Of course, it's, you know, a first opportunity at management, but I'm very, very aware, you know, of the disappointingly no number of Black managers and coaches in England in particular, where Black players have made such a positive contribution to football in this country. So clearly for me, there is extra significance, you know, in my role, in my appointment. Again, what I must say is at my football club in particular, you know, my chairman and ownership group are fantastic. You know, they've never had an issue with promoting people from within, regardless of colour. You know, they feel that if you're worthy of doing a job, you know, your colour does not even come into it. And again, they've proven that with this appointment so far. So, you know, I'm a really privileged position in the sense of being afforded this opportunity. And I'm certainly hopefully going to make the most of it. And again, I'm aware of how important it is for Black coaches and managers in particular.
You've given us a lot to discuss already there, Joby. But just before we get into to the meat of it, you're wearing two hats. You're occupying two positions here. One as a player, and as you rightly point out, where Black and minority ethnic are so well represented in terms of playing numbers and playing staff within football clubs. But you're also in the hat of a manager, and where we are desperately underrepresented. How have you found that kind of balance, or that uniqueness of the two positions? How do you balance that in your head and in what you bring to the training ground day in, day out?
Well, it's a great question. It's probably one I'm still working out myself, Shaka, if I'm being honest. I think the biggest thing for me was to create that clarity that, you know, I am certainly the man in charge. I'm the one making decisions on team selection, how we're going to play, all that sort of stuff. So for the first couple of weeks, it was really important. I've kind of put the playing on the back burner, just certainly temporarily, to give myself that space and really, again, create that real clear message for the boys and how the group's going to work as a staff. Over the past week, 10 days, I've kind of eased my way back in, certainly to the day-to-day aspects of training as and when I can. Again, there's still going to be a role for me on the pitch. I'm still very much available, you know, when the time is required. And it is about getting a balance. You know, I don't want the management side of things to get watered down and diluted too much, certainly. But at the same time, if there are times that on the pitch that I'm needed and I feel I can contribute to help us get in a win, because ultimately, whether I'm a manager or a player of Leyton Orient, I want to win football matches, and it's just working out the best way to do that. So the players have been fantastic. You know, they've really responded to the work we've put into them. Again, for me, it's about me as an individual, the things I stand for, the things I demand and I expect, whether that's me as a player, a captain, now as a manager. So stand in front of the lads as the gaffer for the first time, I'm not going to tell them anything I wouldn't tell them when I'm leading them out as a captain or standing beside them as a teammate. You know, I think there's certain principles that I've always tried to stick with and abide by. And they certainly will be the same for me during my management career because they've stood me in such good stead from a playing point of view. So enjoying the challenge, a few more grey hairs, unfortunately. Other than that, all good so far.
And then, Jobs, just, I mean, this is as far as the starting point that we always kind of do start with every guest that we've had on this on these episodes of The Conversation, and that is just taking it back to 2020, summer 2020, which obviously 2020 was a tough year for all of us because of the pandemic. But I also keep saying I think it was a really good year in terms of progression, in terms of people just reaching their breaking point with dealing with racism and social injustices. And unfortunately, it had to stem from what was a horrific killing of George Floyd. And I just have to ask you, you know, when you saw that and you saw everything that was going on in the United States, living here now in England, I saw how it really stirred everyone here, especially in the sporting world. We saw players like Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford as well, really finding their voices. We've seen more players that you know very well too, some of your boys that you know as well from Watford, that really started even posting the racist messages that they get, whereas before they probably just tried to sweep it under the rug. Just how would you describe, you know, your mental state and your emotions seeing all of that going on last year summer, especially as a father of children that are mixed?
Yeah, it was a real heavy time, if I'm being honest. I think emotionally, I think that was probably the biggest thing. Although this horrible incident happened on the other side of the world, you know, I and a lot of certainly my friends, family, people that I knew, you know, it had a real personal negative feeling that it stirred up inside, you know, seeing such, again, and listen, this is not the first instance, we're all aware of that, but you know, I think it, as you say, we just got to a breaking point where it certainly stirred something in me emotionally, and you know, I think along with the sporting world and the world in general, I think it was a real, for me, watershed moment. You know, for so long, for so many years, as you've said, that we've probably had to downplay these incidents, you know, maybe our own personal experience. I spoke about, you know, daily things in terms of going into shops and security guards, you know, looking at me a little bit differently. I might go to a car showroom and, you know, people might be looking at me as if, can you really afford the car that's in the showroom? You know, the real day-to-day stuff, you know, that I think you have to suppress. You know, my dad's Jamaican, you know, born and bred, moved over here, part of the Windrush generation, and some of the things that that generation had to go through. And a lot of it was, you know, turn the other cheek just to get by, you know, just to survive, just to live, you know, and even the living standards were nowhere near the level they should have been afforded. And I think over the generations, that's kind of carried on. Even when I was a kid at youth level, there were comments, you know, racism in academies. And again, you know, there's a white guy who's head of an academy, his future, or my future, sorry, is in his hands. Mm-hmm. So can I go speak out against that guy? You know, even though I knew it was wrong, you know, friends around me knew it was wrong, but could I go out and say, look, I think there's been an incident of racism here? You know, that power that they held and they still hold today is something that is very difficult at times to overcome. So I think the biggest positive, if anything, that can come out of it is that we felt that this was a time that we can speak out now. We can talk about how it's made us feel. And hopefully, you know, again, things aren't going to change tomorrow. We know that, you know, we certainly want change as quickly as possible and at the highest level. But for the generations to come, when I speak about my kids, as you touched on there, you know, hopefully if they encounter situations in the future, there'll be a time where they can speak on it. We're always going to get racism, unfortunately. But it's when it is happens, it's got to be called out and it's got to be dealt with, you know, in the strictest possible way and zero tolerance shown. And I think we've had incidents of that where people have been more confident to speak out. And I'm just hopeful that, you know, off the back of all the horrible and negative stuff that's happened, you know, some positivity and change can come.
and give them the response, the gravitas, the emotion around everything that you saw in that first half of 2020, how do you think the game on the whole responded?
I think, again, for me, sport is a very, very powerful engine. You know, it's something that, you know, if we talk about taking the knee, and I know that's now got to a point where there's various viewpoints on it, but certainly around the time when the restart happened, again, for me, it's a really powerful thing. It's about, you know, people being together. I think that's the biggest thing. You know, everyone talks about, oh, it's just a black issue. You know, it's not, you know, it's discrimination, whatever the color. Of course, you know, as black people, it hurt us that it was a black man in that instant, but there's obviously incidents around the world with various different forms of racism. And again, from our point of view, seeing that solidarity and everybody standing together, that's the only way we're ever going to really help drive the change, is by everybody coming together. And again, I think that the big point that it wasn't just black people saying, hang on, this is a problem. You know, I had teammates saying, like, I want to kneel with you, man. Like, people reaching out, my friends, white friends, like, what can I do? Like, you know, how can I help? And, you know, it was, again, a time that, despite all the negativity, I did feel there was a positivity around and a desire to want to change. And again, it's about what we do with that now. We can't let it go quiet. You know, we can't let things get brushed under the carpet. All right, you've had your time now, you know, your 6 months, your year, whatever it is. Now we're going to move on, which in the past, again, is something that we've seen over and over again. So it's very important that we keep the conversation, you know, on the front pages, you know, at the top of the conversation list, and make sure we keep driving and striving for the change that we all want.
You mentioned taking the knee. What's your position on that right now? You hear the points raised by Wilfred Zaha as example for him not wanting to take the knee any further. We've also spoken to Les Ferdinand, direct footballer QPR, and they don't take the knee themselves. But how do you feel around taking the knee as a symbol, continuing to take the knee, or some of the points or counterpoints to it all?
Again, I think it's really important, Shaka, that, listen, the actual knee and the gesture itself has obviously got a lot of publicity and a lot of attention. I think it's very important we don't lose focus of why we're taking the knee. And I think in the do we, the don't we, some are, some aren't, I think, unfortunately, that, again, can get a little bit lost in translation, I suppose. I get the side of the argument that it is just a gesture, and of course it is. You know, us getting down on a knee is not going to stop racism tomorrow, of course not. But my point always has been that something is better than nothing. And I genuinely feel, and I know players in particular, you know, white players, that feel by being able to participate and again show that solidarity, they've been very, very keen to partake in that and be part of the movement for change. You know, it might be one small little thing that a group of people can do within a football club, for example. But again, when it's done in a Premier League, that is going around to millions and billions of homes and people around the world. And again, at the worst case, if it sparks a conversation, my boys asked me, so Zaha, for example, the other day, didn't take the knee. We watched Crystal Palace. So he sees Zaha standing. And again, listen, I absolutely respect his viewpoint on this. There's no wrong or right for me at this moment in time. As long as you have a reason, a valid point, and he's made his points absolutely crystal clear, and I absolutely, you know, respect those views. And again, it's a conversation I then have with my little boy, you know, and he gets another little bit of perspective or a little bit of understanding on the situation that maybe if we're not doing it, he doesn't. And again, for me, it's all about that next generation. So again, listen, it's something that I think there's been a lack of leadership on, certainly from the government, governing bodies. I think there should have been maybe a deadline as to when we're going to do it or how long we're going to do it for. So again, to keep that clarity. But the biggest thing for me is that we are together. You know, we can't get splintered. We can't get separated. And all the viewpoints all get mixed up. And then for me, it then starts losing its effect a little bit.
Then, I mean, Jobes, you just mentioned, of course, having to have that conversation with your little boy. And I know we've, Shaka has even said how he's had to have difficult conversations with his own kids, especially living in the United States. We've had a couple other guests on too, you know, Anton Ferdinand, who said that he, at least back then, his parents almost tried to shield him from the racism that was out there, you know, and it was only until he probably started playing professionally and then that incident happened with John Terry that everything kind of hit him. What was it like for you? You mentioned, of course, your dad being part of that Windrush generation, which we know had to endure so much. What was it like for you, I suppose, growing up and getting into football professionally? Did you encounter many difficulties there because of that?
I've got to be honest, I was quite fortunate. I grew up in Tottenham, North London, which is an incredibly diverse, multicultural. It's actually probably one of the most diverse places, certainly in the country and I believe around the world, in terms of, you know, so many different races and groups that come together and live together pretty harmoniously, I've got to be honest. So growing up as a kid, it was never really an issue for me being a mixed race boy growing up in Tottenham, you know, where I'd see other mixed race kids. I had black kids in my class, white kids in my class, Asian kids, like, you know, all races, all backgrounds. And everyone just got on it. And my dad's always made a point of letting us know his story, his journey. So I've been very, very aware of that. Of course, his journey is different to mine because I'm growing up in a different time to his. But there's certainly a lot of elements of his journey that over the years, as I've got older, I certainly start to see how they've now impacted my life. And I've got to be honest, I'm similar to Anton. Probably it wasn't until I started professional football that I really encountered racism for the first time. Mm. I remember going to a notorious South London football club in the youth team for Wimbledon. We had a FA Youth Cup match and we won the game. A group of fans decided to stay. So by now we're like 16, 17 years old. A group of fans decided to stay after. And again, we had a good group of black players at the time, probably 6, 7, 8 across the youth team. And they stayed after the game and then started basically racially abusing the players. I've also encountered another couple of football clubs that I've been at from the crowd. So again, it is, listen, it's something that unfortunately is in society in general. Again, from a football point of view, what we have to make sure is if it does happen, it is dealt with and, you know, there is an absolute, you know, zero tolerance policy towards racism. And ultimately, we want to see that governing bodies, clubs, whoever it is, are taking the strongest possible action because we're never, ever going to eradicate it. That's the sad thing about it. I think we all understand that. But we have to understand when it happens, it has to be dealt with properly. And again, over the years, I don't see it, certainly think that's been the case on a lot of occasions.
Alexis talks about the incident between John Terry and Anton Ferdinand. When you have instances like that at the highest level in the Premier League, the backlash is swift, or the response at the very least is swift, and you see it. But as someone who's spent as much time as you have playing football at both the highest level and through the different professional leagues, different levels of leagues in English football, the big complaint has always been that when something like that happens in one of the lower leagues, it goes unreported. There's nothing that's ever done about it. How has your experiences or contrast your experiences between playing at the higher level or when you're faced with such instances in League Two, as you are now?
Yeah, again, I've got to say from mine or teammates' experiences that have been with me when it has occurred, whether that is, you know, at a higher level or lower down, it has been dealt with pretty swiftly. Again, if it's a matter of a report having to be taken there and then, that has happened. And then I believe there was one incident when I was at Watford and the person in question was identified and then banned. I think it was from Plymouth, Argyle at the time. So that was dealt with, again, as well as it could have been, I suppose. Again, I understand that when it's a higher profile incident, you know, it's going to garner, you know, more attention, more headlines, but that shouldn't be the case. You know, racism is racism, no matter what level. And clearly, if it occurs in the lower leagues, it again should be dealt with as it would be in the Premier League. Again, the sad thing about that, when you hear players that have had to go through that process at times, they end up feeling like, you know, they're the one in the wrong somehow. You know, they're getting asked questions, they're, you know, being put on the stand, so to speak, as if they've done something wrong. And again, that's something we really need to get away from and make sure that it's very clear who the perpetrators are when these horrible things happen.
And then, I mean, I just want to, of course, get back into the managerial side of it as well and just read some, obviously, numbers that came out last year when we all started, I suppose, getting more interest into why we are seeing so few mixed race managers or black managers or of other ethnicities that just aren't white in English football. And it says, you know, at least last year, around last summer, there was give or take around 500 players in the 20 Premier League squads. More than a quarter of those are black or mixed race. But Joby, something happens when they retire that doesn't lead them into managerial positions as much as we would like to see. And, you know, we had a good friend of ours from the cricket world, Ebony Rainford Brent, and she likes to say that, you know, if you don't, it's hard for people that if they can't see it, they feel like they can't beat. And, you know, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank even said last year that he knows several black coaches that just don't even bother get their coaching badges because he's like, look, what's the point? I'm not going to get a look in, because we do tend to see a recycling of the same names over and over and over. And we're not saying that, you know, just chuck in a black manager just because, but at least have them be a part of the conversation at some point. For you, how did you, I suppose, deal with it? Did you ever feel like you probably wouldn't get a look in because of who you were and how you looked? And I guess your conversations with probably some other players that may be feeling like that.
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point to start with about if you can't see it, how can you be it? I mean, I started playing football because of John Barnes. You know, he was a hero of mine growing up, obviously born in Jamaica. You know,
Liverpool.
Liverpool, who I ended up supporting, you know, a real prominent player, a captain, you know, so I saw that. I saw, you know, a black man doing those things and believed because of that, I could walk that same path. It's the same when I got into Wimbledon, you know, the crazy gang, back of the crazy gang era, we had the likes of Robbie Earl, you know, Marcus Gale, Cole Leeburn. Again, they weren't just any squad players. They were captains, senior players. So through my scholarship, I'm seeing these guys, I'm around them, and I'm thinking, well, again, they're doing it. That's something I want to do. I can aspire to do it. It's a very, very important thing. And I think the lack of certainly visibility when it comes to players, then not seeing that translate into management and coaching definitely can have an impact in terms of maybe the desire to go and then get the qualifications that you need. I think there's also certainly white counterparts, ex-pros or players that have played the game that don't even need to be as qualified and they still get opportunities, you know, and it comes down to, for me, a lack of opportunity. I know some fantastic ex-players that have got absolutely every qualification that they need to coach and manage at the highest level in this country, but they're not afforded the same opportunities, again, as some of their white counterparts, whether that is, as you say, the old guard that we always hear about that get, you know, job after job after job, or some of the up-and-coming young coaches. You know, we look at a Graham Potter, a Steve Cooper, who, by the way, have done really, really good jobs, and it's never, ever a slight or a knock on them, but are those opportunities being afforded to young black coaches with similar black backgrounds? And for me, the answer is no. So I definitely think there is an element of a disappointment that maybe because there isn't as many out there that we can see, that there might be a bit of a turn off. But I also think that's a bit of an easy cop out. I think it's an easy one for people to say, oh, well, they're not going to do this or they're not getting their badges. They are. I know they are because I speak to black coaches on a regular basis, who again are working through the England youth setups, working at Premier League level, have got years of experience, and they're just simply not getting the opportunity, whether that's an interview, if they actually do manage to get a job and it doesn't quite go fantastically well, what's their next opportunity? You know, I think Jimmy Floyd's a fantastic example of that. And I've spent time with Jimmy. I've done a bit of work with him on the media side of things. And, you know, it's great to see him back and doing so well. But he's had to go back to Burton to get that opportunity again. When so many other managers that have operated at the level he has will get straight back into another Championship club, for example, or another Premier League club. And again, that's the sort of cycle that we need to break. We need to see, again, Sol Campbell, for me, is a prime example. When you stack his playing career against his counterparts and his first job that he ends up having to go and take and actually ends up doing really, really well, but he has to go down to League Two to get that first job. He isn't given, you know, a really good either Premier League or really good Championship job to go and start. And again, for me, talking from my experience now at League Two and with the greatest respect to the players that I'm around, it's harder work. You know, if you're going into a league, a Championship or Premier League type team, for me, you've got the players there that you can go and mould, you can make play a certain way. The lower down you get, the harder it is. And a lot of the times you'll see those opportunities given at a level that, quite frankly, is quite difficult to succeed in. You only have to look at the turnaround and the shelf life of managers in general, but particularly for black managers, you know, it is certainly an issue and something that we need to try and address as soon as we can.
I think without question, it's a pipeline issue, as you describe it. In October of 2020, the FA introduced its diversity code in an effort to address some of these shocking numbers that we see around diversity in football management and coaching up and down the leagues. What's your opinion of that diversity code? It's a step in the right direction, but is it a large enough step, do you think?
Listen, Shaka, I would like to see more done. Again, I think it almost goes along the lines of, oh, but we're doing something. Try and help. But for me, it's not enough and it's never going to be enough until we see better representation, you know, higher numbers and again, higher opportunities. I'm never, ever going to sit here and say, give a guy a job for the sake of it. You know, that should never happen, you know, but you have to give people an opportunity to go and do that job in the first place, you know, and we're never going to know if the next young black coach is good enough to do the job unless he gets an opportunity to do it, you know? And I think that's, for me, the biggest thing. And in terms of, you know, coming back to the diversity code, it's a step. It's a step in the right direction. But again, we need to come away from the little step stuff and start getting things a lot quicker and a lot sooner. And again, getting people that are qualified and have the experience into the jobs that they deserve to be in.
And then finally, Jobs, I suppose in an effort to end on a positive note, because obviously, like we're saying, we're talking to you in what you have realized is such a good position and a privileged position now that you can at least physically be that representation of what other, you know, young aspiring black and other ethnic minority players who may want to be coaches one day can actually see. Do you feel like that we are onto a change, whether we're already in it or we're starting in the little stages? I know, as Shaka said, there's a diversity code. You know, you've spoken about how Leyton Orient FC have been really great and open in that as well. We know the introduction of the Rooney Rule as well that came in 2019. Do you feel like we are at a turning point?
Oh, that's a good question.
You can be honest too, though, because we all know that this is not a battle, it's a war, and it's far from over.
Yeah, listen, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And at the moment, the numbers are way too low. Again, in terms of my own situation, I know for a fact that any manager who applies for a job at Leyton Orient Football Club, regardless of colour, is going to be given a job in terms of who they think the best man for the job is. You know, I think, again, the more ex-players, coaches we can get in these positions, because I think leadership is a big, big factor in whether someone goes and employs you as a manager. And again, that comes down to maybe previously in previous generations, that opportunity not, again, being afforded to black players in those real big leadership roles. So I think it's certainly something that, again, I think is heading in the right direction, but there is still issues and we need to get, again, more representation. Again, if the Rooney Rule is something that is implicated properly, then again, it just gets people in the door. It's giving people an opportunity to, at the very least, have an interview, sit down. It might change someone's view who didn't perceive a black man to be what is necessary to go and lead a football club. You know, it could be one interview that someone goes, oh, actually, yeah, he was actually really good, and he might not have ever been given that opportunity to do it for. So anything that can be proactive in that and help it, I'm certainly behind and think we need to drive and, you know, keep the movement and the momentum going.
Massive thanks to Joby for sharing his thoughts on the conversation. And next week, the football vibes continue and we take it old school as Watford great and former England international Luther Blissett will lend his voice to the conversation. Don't miss it.